Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here today with co-host Russ Chianelli. And today we're going to be talking about some aspects of neuroscience. How is it that we remember how to go home? Why is it that we sometimes forget how to go home and don't know where we are? Well, to answer these questions, because Russ and I still know how to get home, is a professor from Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. Her name is Melissa Chi, and she's an assistant professor of neuroscience. And so she has all the answers to those questions that I just asked and many more also. So, Melissa, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Before we get into how to find our way home or how we forget things or not know how to do things, let's learn a little bit about Melissa Chi. How did you grow up to be a scientist? What were those formative years?
The formative years began when I started university, of course. So I
So you didn't have this when you were five or six,
guests? This was a I did not have a very laid out plan. I would say when I was a teenager, I was not the most organized student. I didn't have a clear cut vision of, oh, I'm going to go into medical school and be a doctor. I was sort of, you know, I do what I like. And according to my mom, can't change the train if it's moving forward. So I finished high school and I knew, you know, given that university was in my home city, so that was the thing you do. You finish high school if you were doing all right. You still kind of liked learning, which I liked. I went to university, and I knew, okay, I'm not really good at English or social science, so science or engineering. And engineering was so much more of how do you do this and do that and solve this problem. And there was a lot of math, and I steered away from that. But then there was science. So I knew, okay, let's do science. And I went through the calendar, the university calendar, and looked at all the programs that it offered. There was some botany, there were some animal things, and physiology and neuroscience. So neuroscience was a fairly new field, and I looked at the blurb, a very short blurb, relatively speaking, and it said about things like, this is learning how humans behave, learning how the brain understands perception. What is psychology? Understanding the mind. And so for me, that was a really curious question, right? It was a study of the unknown.
And a study of something you also took for granted, in a sense. Mm-hmm. You don't think about how it is you know how to go home.
Right.
Right?
You
just go home.
Think about, you've got peripheral vision, but you don't really think about that. It just exists. The world exists, but it's all because your brain allows it to do so.
And where was your world? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, which is right along the Rocky Mountains. So
very far north.
Very far north. It's the northernmost metropolitan city in North America. So metropolitan being defined by X number of population per, you know, square kilometer of geographical area.
Right.
So it's a fairly cold city, but we call it a dry cold, so it's all right somehow.
We call it down here a dry heat, right? I mean, the dry seems to cover a multitude of sins. Right? It's still cold there,
and
it's still
hot. You don't want to be
wet. Well, that's right. Russell's anathema to rain. So anyway, you went to the university in Edmonton,
University of Alberta.
And got a degree, an initial degree in neuroscience.
Right. So I got my bachelor's of science in neuroscience. And then I think one thing just led to another. I really enjoyed what I was studying. So
do you ever think back and say, maybe I should have done this? I mean, when you were younger, was there any other thing that really intrigued you?
Well, when I was really younger, I didn't really know what really intrigued me. Maybe other than teasing my little brother or, you know, doing random naughty little girl things. But in terms of career, there was no formative idea of I want to do this and I'm going to do that. I think I was fairly carefree.
As an undergraduate studying neuroscience, was there an undergraduate research sort of activity that you got involved in?
Yeah. So I actually started out falling in love with organic chemistry. And then there was one summer where I started to see the field of neuroscience bridging with sort of organic chemistry. And that was when we talked about, in this one day, in this journal club style seminar, about the ion channel, the potassium channel. And this lab that I was working in, it was an organic chemistry lab, and they were doing a presentation on the crystallization of a potassium channel. And at the time, they were really into the crystallization process. They were chemists. And me, as a neuroscientist, I was really into, oh, it's an ion channel. I know what that is. It's the basis of an action potential. It's the basis of how neurons talk to each other. And they were really unsure. So I was a lowly undergraduate, second year student, summer student, and they were graduate students. And I revered their knowledge and expertise. And they couldn't understand sort of the function of a potassium channel, right? So they were interested in the isolated channel, but what, you know, the structure of it. But in order to make a presentation, they need to present things like, well, what does it do and how does it fit in with, you know, why does it exist? And they were quizzing each other and trying to get answers. And then I was like, well, it's a potassium channel, guys. How could you not know what a potassium channel does? And then in that moment, I felt kind of important. I had a piece of knowledge that I didn't know was so unique that I could share. And the ability to share my knowledge was really gratifying. And I think that's what allowed me to continue to do a PhD and then to now be in the position that I'm in.
And you stayed in Edmonton for the PhD?
I did. So I stayed in Edmonton.
So you were in no hurry to leave this cold, dry climate, right?
I like the cold. I like winter.
You like to ski and stuff like that?
I'm actually not very good at winter sports.
So what else do you do in the winter if you like it so much? Just stay indoors, keep warm, and look out the window and
well,
see how beautiful it looks.
Exactly. No, really. Okay. I like to walk in it, and I like the snow is soft. And if a city knows how to do winter right, which I think Edmonton does,
yes,
snow is fluffy and dry, and it's not hurtful.
Do they show the movies on the mountain like they did in Alaska when I was there? And the cars drove up and they were actually outdoor theater on the mountain in the snow?
No, it's not quite like that. But since Edmonton, I've then lived in cities where I think they don't know how to do winter right. So it made me really appreciate Edmonton's winters.
Well, you're in a city now that in El Paso that doesn't have a winter. So, I mean, we don't do it right. We don't do it.
So well, if you do it, you better do it right. If you don't do it, that's fine.
So let's talk a little bit about the initial research that you were engaged in as a graduate student. What was your focus?
So the focus of my lab was to teach me this technique called electrophysiology. So electrical, physiology, essentially the study of the human body. So electrophysiology is using this technique to study electrical currents in human organs, being the brain. So electrophysiology is essentially recording the electrical currents from a neuron. A neuron is a brain cell. So why is that important, right? So a neuron is all the little cells in the brain, and they talk to another. So neurons do not function in isolation. They function as like a telephone. So the way they talk to each other is electrical currents. They give each other a little zap, so to speak. What I can do is tap into each of these single cells and listen in on their conversation.
And so therefore you would have a patient or volunteer, you'd hook them up with lots and lots of receivers on the head. How do you do the experiment in the brain without having to rather destroy the person's brain?
So what I actually do is, you're right, you can have one situation where you record from the human brain using these electrodes, and you've probably seen those images of the individual with the little scalp, little toque, and then with electrodes sticking out. That's an extracellular recording, and you can certainly record that, EEGs. But what I do in the lab is the volunteer is not human. The volunteer is a rodent, in this case, a little mouse. And this is the gruesome part, the mouse. We can skip the gruesome part, but essentially I have to take the brain out of the mouse. So the mouse would have to be decapitated, I saw.
Okay.
So once you've taken the brain tissue out of the mouse, you can keep it alive, quote-unquote alive. And then I cut thin sections out of the brain, and I can see it under a high-powered microscope. And I then take a very fine glass pipette and move it to the cell that I've identified I want to record from, and then I listen in.
There's several issues there. And the first one is that a decapitated brain has what relationship to a non-decapitated brain? That is, you're looking at something in total isolation from the rest of the body. Mm. Is it just an act of faith, or is it now understood that the results that you get from the individual slices of the brain that you're taking are in fact truly representative of a functioning living brain on a head that's not been removed?
That's a very good question. In science, we, of course, the ideal situation is to take an intact brain in a freely moving, happy mouse and tap into that brain cell. Well, you can imagine that that's not essentially possible, right? So you weigh the pros and cons of what you do. On one hand, you want to be able to see or listen in on the cell, but how do you do that? You can't do it in a freely moving mouse. You can imagine that's not really possible. It's going to be in pain. It's freely moving. You've got a really tiny needle in the skull. If it's moving, it's going to get ripped off and all sorts of trauma would happen, yeah. Right? So neuroscientists argue that you can take the organ, keep it essentially alive out of the skull, and still be able to see the environment of the brain tissue.
And so that's an act of faith, or now there's enough data to show us that what you learn from that isolated experiment does apply to that mouse when it's functioning?
I believe so. So there are some technologies nowadays, modern neuroscience is getting into this idea of optogenetics,
yes,
where they are able to stimulate these neurons. So if you think of the brain as a bowl of beads, so tiny little beads, different colors, different shapes and sizes, and they're all mushed in this bowl. And if that's your brain, right, you need to be able to tease out bead A, say the blue bead versus the red bead, and what does the blue bead do and what does the red bead do? But how do you do that in this bowl where they're all jumbled in and they're really tightly packed together? Optogenetics allows you to go in there, you know, specifically express a protein that labels just your blue bead. It's able to selectively isolate just the blue ones versus the red, blue, black, other beads, and say turn it on. And they can do that using light, a blue light of a certain wavelength. And you can turn on the bead that you've selected, and then match it to a behavior. So you turn on this neuron and see the behavioral outcome in the living mouse. Okay, so that's one aspect of it.
So now this is a mouse that's intact.
Intact, right. Freely moving, yeah. Behaving.
And is this technology going to supersede the decapitation, slicing type of experiment?
They need to go hand in hand. And you approach it at different levels. So far, what I've done in my lab is to do it in the brain in the dish part. And then my next step is to take that circuit that I've now identified in the dish and see if it is going to stay true in an intact mouse.
So let's ask one simple question before we take a break. If you look back on your doctoral thesis, what was the main outcome of that thesis? What did you learn that was a sort of a moment said, my gosh, what was the moment when you said, good Lord, I've learned something really fundamental here that we didn't know before? What was that fact that you learned?
Well, I learned many things. I don't think I could pick out one fact, but there were a lot of things that I thought were cool about what I was doing. I mean, the fact that I could record from a single brain cell is right. Very cool. I still think it's very cool. And then that the area of the brain that I was studying, it's called the hypothalamus. It's an incredibly complex region, but it serves a lot of very important and fundamental functions of human life. Some of the pleasures of life, you would say, you know, sleep, sex, satiety, the three S's. My interest in the brain and neuroscience is the satiety aspect. How does the brain control food intake? And this could, you can imagine, be relevant for human disorders like obesity and other associated metabolic diseases.
Okay, so your work has got some relationship to what I might call reality. There is the end of the rainbow. If you know as much as you want, then we're going to say, well, finally, here's a way to be able to treat, in this case, obesity, right?
Mm-hmm.
We'll come back and discuss that. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And our guest today is Melissa Chi from Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada, assistant professor of neuroscience. And we'll be straight back after a short break. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Professor Melissa Chi from Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. So that was the sort of introduction that you had. Undergraduate, learning that chemists didn't know what you knew, but you didn't know what chemists knew, and thinking how to apply these knowledges into study of neuroscience. Now you're an assistant professor at Carleton, and you're going to be focusing, I think, if I gather, on some aspects of brain activity that relate to real problems like obesity.
That's
so
right.
Let's talk about what you're aiming at and what you've discovered.
Sure. So maybe I should start with a bit of a background.
Please.
So if you think about eating, you eat, well, you should be eating when you're hungry, and we do. But then there is the other aspect of eating when you know...
Overeat.
Right. Or you eat because you saw a bowl of chocolate chip cookies and you want to eat it. Why? Because it tastes good and you have a memory that it tastes good. So we eat because there's hunger-driven eating, which is necessary for maintaining, replenishing your depleted energy and nutrient reserves. Okay, that's it's a sustainable thing.
That's called normal.
That's called normal. And then there's hedonic eating, which is also normal because, you know, we're humans. There are things that drive us to do something because it's pleasurable. And then there are things that we stay away from because we hate the taste of it. And that's also normal. But in part of what is perhaps driving the issues of, you know, body weight and losing control of our body weight, and we overeat something, you gain extra calories, you put on extra fat, and that's overeating. You know, when chronically, that can lead to obesity. So my tackle, or what I've chosen to tackle, is how can we look at these neural circuits, these brain cells? Well, first of all, which are the brain regions that control eating, both homeostatic, so hunger-driven eating, versus pleasurable, hedonic-driven eating, the ones that drive us to eat chocolate just because we see chocolate? And then tying them together, because I think that once we can identify those basic circuits, understanding, you know, fundamentally what is happening in our brains that's causing these fundamental human behaviors, we can then go on to have therapeutics that can maybe help curtail our appetite, perhaps, or at least help facilitate weight loss. So there are different aspects of that.
One of the aspects of people who eat too much, I think there's, maybe I'm wrong, it just seems to me that I see a lot of people who eat, in a sense, because they're bored. Right, you know, they don't want to read a book, they don't want to listen to a piece of music, they certainly don't want to go out and jog, and so they're a little bored, and then they pick up a bar of chocolate or an English muffin toasted well, who knows what. Is boredom also an issue that you can find a part of the brain that says, ah, this person's bored, and therefore certain things get communicated up there?
I think that's a question for another neuroscientist.
Okay.
There are people out there who do that sort of research.
I have a question, too. You know, you're talking about measuring the brain functions and all that. Do you ever think about modifying them? Like going in there and changing the blue ball into an orange ball to make them don't eat?
Sure. So there are some techniques. Some you can use transgenic animals where you can overexpress the blue ball, make it a giant blue ball, for example, or make it a super tiny blue ball so it's so minuscule that it fails to have an effect on the function. So these transgenic tools allow you to say, it really gets to the question of what is the blue ball doing. Let's say the blue ball makes you eat. Now, if you turn on the blue ball a lot, so you overexpress the blue ball and you eat more, then you can say, well, the blue ball is making you eat. By the same rationale, you could say, if I make the blue ball disappear, if I remove the blue ball and the animal fails to eat or stops eating, then you've got now two lines of evidence saying when there's lots of the blue ball going on, it's eating. When the blue ball goes away, it doesn't eat, then you know that the blue ball is related to eating.
Can you modify those parts of the brain to make them do a different function?
I don't know about making do different functions, but you can make functions appear or disappear.
So let's go back to the concept of habit, because habit is sort of learned memory, I suppose. I'm not quite sure. I'm not very good at neuroscience, but I do know there are certain things I do out of habit.
Sure.
All right? And regardless of whether I get pleasure from them or not, is there another part of the brain that just tells you to do things because
sure.
of memory as opposed to pleasure, etc.?
Sure. That would be a memory circuit, right? So if you talk about habits, sometimes you do things without thinking about it. You ride a bike, you get on a bike after 30 years and you don't think about it, you can still do it. that's what you call, you know, muscle memory, right? That's one form of memory. And then there's the other part of memory where you actively engage to remember something. For example, your name, Keith. I have to actively tell myself to remember this. So that's two types of memory. And I think habit falls more into the muscle memory. But it's interesting because, of course, when you first learn how to ride a bike, you have to actively engage to learn it, right? So there's one form of declarative memory where you try and then you keep doing, and then it can switch, I think, to that other form. And I almost wonder if studying, when you go to university and you study, or you're in elementary school, you study, studying habits, I wonder if that's also declarative, but then becomes muscle. You learn skills, which initially is hard. It's declarative. You teach yourself these skills to do something, but then once you've learned it, you can just do it without thinking about it. So I think there's an easy transition that way.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking, and you know, certain habits or certain memories, I guess, that I have. And one is that I know I'm very bad with names, right? I know you're Melissa, but that's because, you know, you're right here in front of me. But if I meet you in about 6 months' time, I'll think, well, gosh, I remember her, but don't have the name. But on the other hand, I can remember pieces of music that I haven't heard in years and tell you what movement it is on what mm-hmm. piano concerto. What's the point here?
I think that what we could get to talk about is when you first form your, for example, in your case, music, perhaps when you were a child, you really engaged in music. And so you, neurons, right? So we started off talking that neurons don't function in isolation. They function as a community. They talk to one another. And sometimes you can think of cells talking to each other in a circle. So I'll talk to you, you'll talk to Russell, Russell feeds me back, and we go around like this. And just like you remember a phone number, right? You recite it to yourself over and over and over again. So it's possible that in the case of music, you hear something, it becomes ingrained, and your brain cells are repeating the cycle. Neuron A to B to A to B to C, and repeats itself, that it becomes really solidified and solid.
So I like the idea that somewhere in my brain, there's hundreds of symphonies and piano concerti and jazz recordings. They're all imprinted in there somewhere, right?
I would believe so.
What a lovely thought.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Let's go back to something which is more problematic. Let's go to obesity, because that's a major issue in the developed countries in particular. But it's also, in North America, it's also something associated with the genetic background. And then certain groups in society are more prone to obesity because of their diet. That's something that society surely should be able to cure. It doesn't need a neuroscientist to say that you don't eat junk food all day. But that's the way society is.
Right. But I'd like to say that I think one of the problems with, you know, we know that obesity is not good for you. It's comorbid with a lot of other associated negative health diseases like diabetes, some forms of cancer, liver disease, right? So why is it that we know that there's this thing that's really bad for you? Why can't we do something about it? And I'd like to go back to the brain. So if you think about obesity as, you know, a broken car, well, you can't fix your car until you understand how the engine works. So the brain is like the engine of the car. So you need to understand the brain circuits that's driving that engine before you can fix the car. So I think that's where we're at in terms of neuroscience. If we believe that the brain has this huge ability to control feeding behavior, to control...
But you're still trying to figure it out.
Of course.
When you go back to the mice tests, was there ever anything you could do that would destroy a function?
Well, for example, there are animals that are mutated in a way that they're obese. There's the leptin knockout animals. When they're missing this little protein, they grow up to be morbidly obese. You treat them back with this protein. You give it back the protein that you've taken away, and then they start to lose weight. And there are humans that have a similar in a human form of that kind of mutation. I believe it's a mutation in the leptin receptor. These are patients that do not make the protein leptin. Now, when you give them leptin, pharmaceutical leptin, you can treat their obesity and they lose that weight very, very quickly.
So you're just giving the mice something and then removing the brain and looking at the response?
I am taking a more bottom-up approach. I'm starting from a neuron that I believe is important for feeding behavior. And this neuron has a name. His name is MCH. Those are the abbreviations. It stands for melanin-concentrating hormone. So what I'm doing is I've taken my favorite neuron, MCH neurons, and first of all, I want to figure out, well, who does MCH neurons talk to, right? Neurons don't function in isolation. They need to talk to someone else to enact a behavior. So my first step is to take this cell and trace where it goes. Where does it talk to? So a neuron, if you imagine, if you close your eyes, imagine a neuron is a ball. And then from the ball, you've got appendages coming out. So arms and legs going all different directions. And you can take the center of this ball and put a dye in the ball, a dye, so a tracer, and figure out where the arms and legs end up. So now you can take that brain, cut it into cross-section, and see where the little fingertips and toe tips are. So when you can image the fingertips and the toe tips, you can see where those brain regions it's communicating with. And where do you start from there, right? So these brain regions, we know something about those downstream regions. We can then take from there, we can figure out what the role of my MCH neuron is doing by then looking at the downstream brain regions, the fingertip regions, and figure out, okay, let's say it's the brain region A. Well, what do we know about brain region A? If brain region A does feeding things, well, then there's good evidence, or at least a line of evidence showing that MCH neurons will be important.
Connects over. So, but do you begin to see feedback? Okay, you've got the neuron here communicating with this fellow down here, and those tentacles, that gets a stronger... Does this one start to sort of feed back to the parents?
Do.
I mean, this
Sometimes
is a feedback
do.
Mechanism, I suppose. Right. Can you see that?
We can do other things to see if it feeds back. And certainly we know in neuroscience that neurons do come back to them. Just say, stop talking to me. I don't want to anymore listen to you. And they'll tell it, stop. So certainly there are some circuits that put a brake on activity.
I'd like to thank you very much, Melissa. Melissa
Chi
from the
me.
Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. And Russell, thank you for being here. And we'd like to thank also Kimberly Garcia for putting the program together. And we'll see you all next week with another riveting Science Studio program. Bye-bye.